All right. Thank you. Thank you all for joining us. John, great.
Welcome, everybody.
In touch with you. So as John and I were talking about how we might use this time, you know, most of the world is into doing, and I want to know, we can't leave a meeting without a list. For us, and for me especially, I'm interested in what people are thinking. Because behind every plan, every program, every institution, every brick and mortar, somebody had a thought and thought about what would make a difference in the world. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to chat a little bit about four questions. One question is what's shifting for us in our thinking. One question is over the years, what's been confirmed for us. Third question is what are we worried about? And then the fourth question at this point, what do we want to do? And so we're just going to start there. Now, we'd like you to join us at any point. You can either put it in the chat. You can dial in and we'll talk to you. But thank you very much for joining us. And, John, let me start with asking you, in terms of your thinking, what do you notice shifting in how you see the world and what's useful?
Well, as I'm 85, so I've seen a lot of shifts through time. But reflecting on that, I think that the biggest shift that I've seen, certainly in the last generation, is the growth of an environment composed of television and the internet. You know, if I said to somebody, do you live in a forest, if they're living on an average street, they'd say, no, but I do have trees around. And I'd say, well, what's the difference between a tree and a forest? And the difference is that in a forest, there are so many trees that instead of it being a people environment, it becomes a tree environment. And the trees shape the world as they become dominant, and they bring different animals and different plants, and it's a completely different environment. I think that what has for me shifted the most in my lifetime is that we tend to be living in a forest of screens, of counterfeit environment, where what we are receiving is not the messages of our senses and our friends and the wonderful world of nature and our interactions, but we're receiving signals and messages from an inanimate world. And to me, that's a huge change. I've never seen anything like it. I go to meetings and there are eight people there. Four of them will put their iPod on the table, sort of announcing, I'm not really here, right? I'm half here. So in my own sense of things, I think that we've become more and more senseless, that our senses are on hold while we live in a forest of electronic symbols. And I think it radically changes how we understand what is a fact, what is truth, what is a value, what is a relationship. And all it's so basic in the shift it's creating away from primary aspects of life that it is to me the wave of the future that's here. And the real question is, how do we begin to get back to a place where we have real trees and real people?
It bothers you, doesn't it?
Yeah. What about you, Peter? What shifted for you?
Well, I answered, instead of what's shifting in the world, I was thinking, so what's shifting in my own relationship to the world, my own thinking about how to be useful. And I think the biggest thing for me is that I've gotten interested in measurement. The core of the work is to construct an alternative story. A lot of your work has been to delabel people. Your revolution you started was to say that maybe people are defined by their gifts rather than their deficiency. And so if I took that seriously, I begin to think that, well, maybe a way to shift the narrative, maybe the narrative is defined by the questions we ask when we say, how are things going? What's worth paying attention to? And most of the measures we have of the world are either of economic progress, financial progress, financial stories, gross national product, gross domestic product. And most of them are deficient. Unemployment, is it high or low? And so we have a bunch of measures that says all we are can be captured by our average annual income, or measures for our communities and asking about crime, asking about disease, asking about elderly. And so I begin to put my thoughts, energy, hopes, and say, well, let's ask different questions. And let's do it on a systematic way that answers everybody's question of how is it going. So that we ask people, what are you productive at? What are you producing that someone would buy? What can you make with yourself? What can you fix yourself? What can you care for? And what's the informal economy look like? Edgar Kahn basically has created a structure in time banking that says there are measures other than what can be captured by money transactions. And so that's kind of what's working on me now. And that the measurement can create either a more autocratic, centralized world, like it's the world of consistency, like high-stakes testing in the schools. The measurements can be ones that believe in consistency, or the measures can be ones that are liberating. So I'm wondering, well, if we measure things, which I think we want to do, are there liberating and unlabeling ways of asking questions about how is a neighborhood doing, how is a community doing? Then the other question is, who should ask it? Right now, we think we want objective third parties to ask the question. So the RAND Corporation makes a lot of money out of that concept. And so the alternative, more intimate way of doing that is to say, well, suppose neighbors ask neighbors on a consistent basis, what's happening here? What are you making? What are you productive at? What's working for you? And so who asked the question and what is the question seem to me to be interventions in and of themselves that might move towards the kind of world that we're all looking for. And so that's what I'm doing. I'm trying to think that way and then work with people who can help me do that. One of the projects I'm on now is having an intern. A graduate student at Xavier say, well, for all the activities that I've been talking about all these years, and you've been talking about all these years, John, what measures are they to show real population outcomes that something has shifted because people find each other and get connected around their gifts? Anyway, that's what's on my mind these days. As usual, I don't know what I'm talking about, but that never stopped me.
That's a good place to start. Right. Let me ask you a second question.
Okay.
What in this point in your life is being confirmed?
Well, I got really simple in this question. One is, when I started this work, I facilitated small groups. And my daughter once called me, I said before, from college, and said, this guy does what you do, Dad. And I said, what did he do? And he said, he broke us into small groups. So I always took it as a sideshow, break into small. Now I believe it has a political power, that somehow it's people in a small group. And Margaret Mead made this famous. She got us all onto this by saying, all change started with a small group. So that's one thing. And wherever I am, I know if we don't break into a small group, but nothing really shifts, really, unless you're there for entertainment, and that's fabulous. The other thing is that there's certain questions that won't let me go. One I got from you, John, which is, what are the gifts? What are you good at? And I still think we're kind of blind to that and still waiting for a eulogy to legitimize that conversation. And the other is the question of, okay, for whatever it is you're complaining about, what's your contribution to having created the very thing that's in your way? And that's a longing for a world of accountability. And for me, it's the portal to freedom. That there's no real freedom unless I imagine myself as a co-creator of the world almost in its entirety, even though my part may be infinitesimal. The conversation of what have I done to help create this situation, even the one I don't like, kind of is a liberating question. That's about it. The rest is waiting to be confirmed.
And, you know, I remember from my college years studying what was then very popular called group dynamics. And one thing that stuck with me was, at least at that point, the social psychologists were saying, small groups are the most effective ways of changing two things in people's lives. The first is what they believe, and the second is how they behave. That no education or propaganda or legislation has ever had the power that small groups have to influence beliefs and behavior. And so I think those are pretty important things, and paying attention to small groups is absolutely central if those are things you're concerned about.
How about you, John? What do you hold now to be true even more so than you used to?
Well, I was thinking about this. I just turned 85, and I was thinking about the life I've led. And a lot of things have been confirmed. A lot of things have been disabused. But when I was young, my father said to me, be careful who are your friends, because they'll make you who you are. And I thought that was sort of a curious idea, that I was probably going to be the product of the people around me rather than a person who, as an individual, made myself. And I think that idea has really been confirmed for me in my life. I think I've just been blessed by having a very adventurous and exciting kind of life, mainly because of the people with whom I became friends. And as I think about who I am, I go back and I think of the influence that the great neighborhood organizer Saul Alinsky had on me here in Chicago, and then my friendship with Ivan Illich and his early institutional critiques, including schools, a huge influence on me. And another good friend was Robert Rodale, who published a lot of magazines like Organic Gardening, Successful Farming, Bicycling. And my relationship with him led me to understand how there is a design in the natural world, and that design, if you pull it apart, if you pull one thread, the whole thing will come apart.
Mm-hmm.
Another friend is Marian Thompson. In fact, she lives a couple blocks from me, the founder of La Leche League. And the wonderful example she gave me of how everyday citizens can come together in groups and overcome the power of professionals who say you shouldn't be breastfeeding. And Jerry Miller, a great reformer in Massachusetts, who decided you can't reform reformatories. What you got to do is look for some other way of approaching young people who are thought to be deviant. And so he emptied the reformatories. And then you, Peter, you came into my life, and what a wonderful, exciting new set of perceptions and understandings I've had about the nature of community and the fact that when you move outside the personal, you're losing everything of consequence that makes these kinds of relationships work. So I see myself as having confirmed what my father told me, that I would probably become whatever I would become, in a sense, the people that surrounded me. And it's a great advice. And I think when I look at them, they're all people who are marginal, who are deviant, who are questioning, who are adventurers. So I wish everybody could have that kind of a life. I think we make it if we want to.
Right. That's great. You know, Maggie, I would invite anybody who wants to join and maybe guide us a little bit at this point. You know, John and I can always keep talking. But it would be interesting if people had questions or statements or things they would like to bring into the conversation. And then we'll just keep going. You interrupt when you get one. Okay, Maggie?
Okay, sure. So, again, just if you're calling, press *8 on your phone or just type something in the chat. Thanks, Peter.
So let me ask you, Peter.
We do have a caller coming in. Shall I?
Good.
I'll take that. Good. Saved by the bell. Hello, this is Maggie.
Hi, Maggie. My name is Joanna Farmer. And first of all, I want to thank you both, all of you all, for having this particular conversation right now, because I knew John McKnight and Jody Kretzman when I was working at the Shorebank Corporation with the Neighborhood Institute.
Expanded
to the Austin community on the west side of Chicago. And that work has shaped and guided my work. I was just in my mid-20s then. And so just still this many years later, working on asset-based community development is challenging because it requires a whole different mindset. And I was listening to what you said earlier, Dr. McKnight, about the screens and how we're separating ourselves. And I look at that as separating ourselves because of technology. So at the same time that technology is wonderful and now we're in the fourth industrial revolution, it's also a way to divide and conquer because it produces inequalities because not everyone has access to that technology. So the people who are making decisions are the ones who have those financial assets or that financial capital. So one of the questions I wanted to ask you and all of you all is, how do we still successfully implement ABCD, even though we're in the 21st century where there are multiple challenges to get people's attention because of, for example, information overload?
Well, I think that's that's the work ahead in my mind. The effort to initiate, to support, to legitimize the value of local people, local citizens. I don't mean that legally. I mean members of democracy coming together and having a vision where they are the principal producers is still the ultimate reform. The reform isn't finally up there. The reform is right here where we are. And I suspect that we've become disconnected enough that a lot of hierarchy has much more influence on us than it once did, because we once had human reference groups that allowed us to share and think together and bring our personal lives into contact and learn. So it's long work, it's good work, it's hard work, and it's always local work in my mind. And I think most of the rest of reform isn't going to have much consequence. Peter, you've just written something about this.
Mm-hmm. You know, I would focus on being a little more, you know, it's really, there's a lot of use to the technology, mostly for my logistical life. That many of the things I do, I can do faster now. And I can communicate, I'll be late, I'll be early, do you want it, this or that. As far as information or learning or knowledge, you know, I don't think much of it really comes through the flat things, the screens. So I would, also I have a choice about what I watch. You know, I can decide not to watch the first 15 minutes of the evening news. I can, you know, I can choose not to scroll through things where advertising outnumbers contact 2-1. And so I think we have a choice. I think you're right that it is isolating, but I don't want to give it too much attention. I really think, like you said, John, what can we create locally? I wrote an article for Quartz, which is online news agency, that one response to the election is to go deeper into what we can control, which is our local right. neighborhood. So I think the neighborhood is going to be central to our future, even our economic future. Anyway, thank you very much for the question. Any comments you'd like to make back to us? Are you still online?
Yes, I'm still here, and I was taking some notes. And the main comment, the feedback that I have given everything that you both have said is I completely agree that we need to be careful where we place our attention. And I've been having discussions with my family and friends and colleagues about this, because sometimes just because of the way that we're bombarded, I don't watch very much television, if you do watch television or you listen to the news, or we have all of these different ways that it comes into our lives now. It penetrates barriers where before you had to actively go and buy a newspaper or look at something, but now it's in front of your face. Like I'm on my netbook, my notebook, for example, and I have things coming up on the right hand bottom of my screen that tell me what is going on in the world, and I really don't want to even be bothered with that right now because I'm working. but somehow or another, these things are set up. When you just said about the hierarchies, there's something going on where it can penetrate your privacy, so to say. So even my private thinking, my ability to just be still and do work and read, this thing is popping up. So I'm working on, because I work with children, that's why I asked you that question, because we've got to figure out a way in asset-based community development to still get to children so that they understand that they can make choices as producers of their lives instead of being consumers of who has their time and attention. So that's why I asked the question, too.
And you're the expert, because I don't think either of us work much with children. So.
Mm-hmm.
We're hoping you're shaping that path.
Yeah, you are, just by asking the question here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any other, Maggie, any other?
No other
okay.
Right, no other callers, Peter, but we do have a couple of comments in the chat. We have an active chat going on this afternoon.
Okay. Oh, wow. Below the line.
I'd like to relay Rich Jones, not just because he loves us, but I like his question. He says, can you chat more on the invisible community that surrounds us?
Well, I think that as our attention is drawn more and more to large institutions and the information that is constantly surrounding us, as we just heard on the screens, that what is immediately there in our world of the senses becomes more and more invisible. We see nothing around us that looks powerful. And incidentally, I think that a lot of people who were pretty angry this time around and voted maybe for Bernie and voted for Trump are people who have a deep sense of powerlessness in the world, that they can't make things happen. And to make things happen, you have to influence everything above you. But if we reinstated our capacity to be producers locally of the world we're living in, I think that shifts the way we feel about ourselves. It reduces our anger, increases our aspiration, increases our sense that we have capacities, we are not impotent, that we are not powerless. And internationalization, I think, is the way to make people feel completely powerless. But if we don't have any place where we're powerful, any place where we produce things that make a difference in our lives, then I think we become fearful, we become frightened, we become a sense of powerless and just say, it's got to change. But it ain't going to change where where we're looking for the change. It's going to change with us.
Yeah, I think it also does give a rise to another level of activism. And so I also want to reflect on what you're saying about the world. I also think what's happening in England and in the United States, you know, we made a promise to our identity, and the American Dream's promise was that, you know, you're going to do better than your parents did, that you'd have your own home. It was a consumerist promise, a chicken in every pot, a car in every garage, upward mobility. I think that promise has been betrayed. And I think at some level we have to renegotiate a different covenant with ourselves, what it means to live in this country or in this era that's not based on the consumerist ambition. And that's why I think what you said is true. We are going to have to produce and make things and be less of a consumerist world, and just by necessity, because all the solutions of college, work hard, get a job, are less available to us now. So I think that's the community movement, the cooperative movement, the local movement is going to get more and more powerful, and our children will be better off than I am, mm-hmm. and my grandchildren. They just won't have the same kind of a path that I had. And that's what we're trying to support with our work.
Anything else, Maggie?
Well, there's another request here on the chat. It says, ideas on how to keep the municipality from usurping the grassroots growth.
Well, I see more and more local municipalities city council people as being realistic about what they are able to do. They can see their budgets aren't growing, and they can see that there are all kinds of problems that people are bringing to them. And it's my experience more and more that both people in local government, from the city manager or mayors to the city councils, are beginning to recognize the importance of local people having the power to create and solve problems. It used to be that a legislator was somebody who brought home the bacon. But I think what's happening now is that more and more legislators and public officials see that they have made that claim too long, too far, and that where we are now is at the place where what they have to do is try to be a precipitator or a stimulator of people at the block and neighborhood level beginning to take more responsibility for things like health and the environment and education. So I'm very hopeful at the local municipal level about the signs I'm seeing.
You know, there's Adam Kahane is a friend of ours, and he's writing a book called Collaborating with the Enemy, and it's not out yet. But he says the challenge is to figure out how to collaborate with people that you don't like, people you don't trust, and people you don't agree with. And he says, he also says that collaboration is always the last resort. Everybody's first choice is to get their way.
Yes.
And their second is to adapt and say, well, I'll find my own little way through this. And so I think that's even more urgent at the local community level, because as we've talked before, John, there is a dark side to community.
Yeah.
There is an inward side to community, a like-mindedness side to community. You see the world being nervous about strangers, immigrants. And so I think the idea of collaboration, last resort, with people you don't like, trust, or agree with is a way of moving forward. And it was very helpful for me to listen to Adam, because I always thought a bunch of like-minded people getting together, having a vision, and making a plan was useful. And what he's suggesting at the local level, it's not that useful. And I see that in Cincinnati. You know, there's a real movement to do something about the wealth inequality here in Cincinnati. And my own notion is, why don't we just declare an end to poverty? Ending poverty is something, is an idea whose time has come. And I think locally we're going to do something about that. And it's not just about the money. It's also about the welcoming people in from economic exile. If there's one renaming that I think is still killing us, it's to call somebody poor.
Yeah.
And that's not how you describe a human being. It has nothing to do with their average annual income. And so that becomes part of the shift in conversation and language. And again, it's back to the gift-mindedness and trying to create, you know, an alternative to this predatory economy. You know, when we asked what we're worried about, John, I wrote down economically produced violence.
Mm.
That the economy we have, which is so competitive and so acquisitive, and so based on growth and progress, it inevitably leads to violence of some kind. And so I think the harder we work at creating an alternative economy, the less violence there'll be in the world, and that's a big issue.
When I thought about the question you just raised, what are you worried about? In Vancouver, about 5 years ago, the Vancouver Foundation commissioned a population study in which they took a sample of all the people in Vancouver and asked them what issues were the most important to them issues, meaning problems, right? And they had the usual list. Is it about health? Is it about your safety? Is it about schools? Is it about snow removal? Whatever. Long list. And then, for some reason, somebody put in isolation. And the final results of that study showed that more people said the primary problem in Vancouver is isolation than any of the normal suspects. And I thought that that really should tell us something, that here we are with cities where people are living on top of each other and their problem is isolation. But it seems to me over my lifetime, particularly in the last 30, 40 years, isolation has grown and grown. Robert Putnam in Bowling Alone has documented how associational life has declined and people are more individualized and isolated. I can't help but feel that this sense of isolation plus the impotence of having no power locally to do anything is the dangerous combination, isolation and impotence. And that our work ahead need, above all, to focus on transforming ourselves from being, alone and becoming connected once again with the capacity to be productive. We can't have a good society of isolated, unproductive people. They will feel impotent and they will do things that aren't good. So in that sense, community organizing is perhaps one of the most significant of all skills that we need to renew among us.
And I think the word productive is shifting its meaning also. I think productive used to mean getting a good job and doing well at it.
Mm-hmm.
I think productive for children became doing well at school. So if you and I have joked that the teenagers is another label for a person who has no use,
Yeah.
And so I think being productive is going to become much more literal. And actually, you mentioned isolation. It made me think my mother always slept with the television on. And I think that was a way of comforting her in her loneliness. To have those voices, even from a distance and anonymous. And I imagine if she was still alive, she'd have flat screens everywhere.
Yeah. Well,
there's a comment somebody made about hope that I always like to hear. Okay, Peter and John, what gives you hope? So I don't know if you want to comment on that, John, that came from the chat. I can comment on it,
You start.
I never am comfortable with the word hope because it means I'm waiting for something. And it's a longing for predictability. And so I always focus more on what's the source of our faith? Where does our faith come from? And the faith ultimately is the capacity, to be with each other in a way that we want to be. And, I think faith comes from, like you said, the people around you determine who you are. And so if you pressured me, I would say I'm not hopeful. I look back over these years and I most of the claims of progress have been in science. And it's granted I do live longer, but is it progress in terms of people's way of being together, in terms of their will to tolerance or their hospitality? I'm not sure, so I don't want to bet my future on progress. I don't want a future on hope. I want to bet it on faith and all the things that probably this group knows about, which is trying to get people to, you know, get connected and find in walking distance what I used to. The other thought I had was that when you said isolation and not being infinite, I think it's isolation and being consumers. I really think we've come to depend so deeply on what I can purchase.
Yeah.
And we wrote about that. That somehow it's an era of making my, if I had hope, it would be in our capacity to create very locally all that I need, which would be much less than I have.
Yes, that's true. That's true. Well, I think I am hopeful. And the reason is that at my age, I was born at the beginning of the Depression. That was pretty bad times. I remember my father wasn't even paid, even though he's a school teacher. They didn't have enough money to tax people to pay him. They gave him pieces of paper called script. But we went through that, and just immediately the Second World War came. And that was terrible, and the gold stars appeared on the streets and the homes of so many people where I lived, and we lived through that. And then there was the Cold War with atomic bombs hanging over our heads. And then there were political movements in the United States that I was not enthusiastic about that took power, I think, starting with the Reagan administration. But, you know, we're still here. And I think as Americans, we've wended our way through an incredible, challenging century. So the other thing that I've lived through is the great movement of people, the labor movement, the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the environmental movement, the LGBT movement, all shifting the very base of the society in very positive ways during all of these difficult times. So I'm very hopeful. There's a movement all around us. We just don't quite see it yet. Somebody asked about what's invisible. I would say what's invisible is the next movement that moves us ahead in terms of freedom and responsibility and community. And so each thing we do in that arena is the little piece that's going to ignite. And the next movement will come forward, and that will be the way we'll have real change and not by the phony change that we're being offered now.
That's great, John. Somebody wrote in the chat that Cornel West said, hope is not the same as optimism. To live is to rest fair, yet never to allow despair to have the last word.
Yeah.
I think in you and my conversation about hope and faith and stuff, I should give you the last word so that Cornel West won't be upset.
No. The crest of my Scottish clan, the motto is, I hope in God. And I've never been quite sure what they meant by that. You know, we have on our coins, our money, I trust in God.
Yeah.
But I come from a group who has hope, not necessarily trust.
I gotcha. I also, every time we part, John, as we've gotten older, we say, I'll see you next time. And then you always say, God willing. So.
Right.
I think you're closer to that crest than you admit.
Yeah.
Maggie, any questions? Anything in line? Anybody like to say anything? Because we're near the end here.
Oh, we have no other callers, and I think you can see the chat, Peter.
Yeah.
But there was a question here that I know that you respond to. It says, my city focuses on the problem of crime and violence. Their answer is more police officers. What can I do to change the conversation?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So, you know, the first thing you can do to change the conversation is not participate in it, not valid, not think that it's true. And then it's hard to fight the patriarchal world. It's hard to fight the dominant paradigm by taking it on directly. What you create is the alternative to it. So you say, well, if the world thinks that police are going to make us safe, it's expensive, and they're wrong. So what can I do to make the world that I inhabit safer than it is now? And it's always in the direction of knowing people's names, knowing the children's names, increasing anything that gets people on the street. Some of us are involved in a market, cooperative market in the neighborhood where we're in, and the main reason I'm interested is just puts people on the street and puts them in touch with each other. But, you know, the world is going to keep believing in things even though they don't work. There's no relationship between police on the street and the amount of crime that there is. And so, you know, it's a great question, but we have to create an alternative vote. And as John says, it's happening. It's just we don't have anybody to tell the story. So another thing that I want to do, if we get to that, John, is I think we're going to have to get together and create an alternative journalism, that we're going to have to join with people like Bill Moyers and Peter Pula in Toronto and say that we need a different storyteller, because our current storytellers, the news, is not doing its job. They totally missed this election by fact-checking. If nothing else, this election is I don't want to make my living as a fact-checker anymore because it doesn't seem to matter. And so I think to create an alternative journalism to give it the integrity that the traditional, you know, there was a time when we trusted our journalists. We trusted Walter Cronkite and Edward Murrow and people like that. So we've got to find voices that we can continue to trust, but we may have to do it ourselves, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
Any things you want to do, John?
Well, on maybe... The question of violence, and especially youth and violence, gives me the opportunity to mention what I am most interested in doing now. It strikes me that in general we have figured out how to raise children by never ever having them have any responsible activity that would allow them to grow up to be citizens, that we age segregate them until they're at least 18 when we send them away. And so I think that all of this focus on youth and violence is a misleading way of thinking about what's happening. I think what's happening is that young people and adults are disconnected. The young people live in school and in a youth culture, and that the learning between young people and adults is lost in most communities. The connection isn't there. There aren't villages where the people are raising their children, not neighborhoods where they are in any collective approach to young people. So, for everybody who's listening and anybody who's interested, we, meaning the ABCD Institute, are beginning to identify neighborhoods or local civic organizations that are interested in discovering what all of the adults and young people in local neighborhood know that they could teach each other. And creating a connection process that results in especially young people being connected with adults in productive roles. I think there's just such a great opportunity to reconstitute those relationships that overcome adults' fear of young people, overcome young people's sense of uselessness, and that school can't do that. Communities have to do it. So we're identifying local places that want to uncover the knowledge that local people have that they're willing to share with each other so that the knowledge locally that isn't taught in the school is now made available especially to young people, but young people make their knowledge available to adults, and we need a civic base, a neighborhood organization, maybe a Y, maybe a church, where that's the focus of what they're doing. If you look at our website, abcdinstitute.org, and look under downloadable publications, you'll see an article called The Educating Neighborhood, which outlines how much information and knowledge and wisdom there is in local communities specifically that can be connected to young people especially. And if you're at all interested in your neighborhood or some organization you're associated with becoming involved in this new initiative, let me know. My email is jlmabcd@aol.com. This is an absolute solicitation, open door. I think it's the wave of the future, reestablishing relationships between productive adults and young people seeking to be somebody who's not useless.
I also like it's the first time I heard AOL.com in a long time, John. That's great.
You have to be 85 to have AOL.
I want to add two more into this conversation. One, the restorative movement, the restorative justice, restorative practices is powerful. It's totally aligned with all the things we're talking about. And so learning about that, Lee Rush and Tom Alina and other people are very out in the world. And so I think the notion of a restorative community is a very powerful idea.
Yeah.
And also when you mentioned the linking, you know, there is a co-housing movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it has in it the possibility that young people and elderly people can be useful to each other. And it's just in the being together. There's even a high school in Massachusetts that has one half of the building is for senior living, and the other half is a grade school or a high school.
Wow.
And there's doors in those walls so those people can move back and forth and be close to each other. That kind of a structural design to me is just brilliant. Well, I think we're probably near the end, John. Any final things you'd like to say? This has really been fun, and it's a nice kind of indulgence, but it's enjoyable. Who would you like to close with, John?
Well, I'd really like to thank you. You've been such a wonderful source of wisdom and experience and friendship that it's hard to imagine the last decade of my life without you. So thanks for being a friend.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So I guess I'll close by saying you're welcome. You know, I feel similarly, you know, there's certain ideas that you wait for. And the idea of gift-mindedness, as soon as I read my first article before you even wrote a book, that I just kind of got it. and we're still trying to live into that. So I would like to thank you all for coming to this. Stay in touch. Let us know, you know, any thoughts you have. Maggie, why don't you close it out, unless there's something on chat that I want to mention.
I think there is a lot in the chat. We will have this conversation transcribed, and I believe we will post it onto the website, and we'll include some of these chat comments along with it, so you get to see the whole conversation. This has been fabulous. I loved listening to you guys. I'd also like to just put a plug in for a website that Peter's working on. It's called restore-commons.com. Restore-commons.com. Go ahead.
I'm glad you mentioned that. It's kind of a warehouse of ideas for John and Walter and people that are along this path. I also, you know, John, you called for people to contact you about a teachable community.
Yeah.
If people know where a real measurement is being done of community building, of social capital and its effects on practical things like safety and raising children, that's also, I'd just love to hear from you, because I would really, this is a good moment to kind of invite that kind of thoughts. And let me give it back to you now, Maggie.
Okay, and to write to Peter, that would be to pbi@att.net. So this has been delightful. Thank you so much, and thank you to everybody who participated. It's been quite lively. I'd also like to invite you to join us the next time, which is going to be on Tuesday, February 21, and we'll be joined by Mike Basher from Fair and Square, which is the first nonprofit grocery store of its kind in the nation. So that'll be an interesting conversation. And until then, please visit our website at www.abundantcommunity.com and stay in touch with us. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll close for today.